Okay, so the idea today is to start off with the Buddha and the Middle Way and as a way in, mainly because I'm assuming that's the main way in which you've encountered the Middle Way, through Buddhism. And obviously it's the main way people hear about it generally. So I'm going to start by talking about the context of the Middle Way in the Buddha's life story and the Buddha's basic teachings, and we'll go on from that. And basically, the further we go on, the further we'll move away from the Buddha, really, so that the other days there won't be very much about Buddhism specifically, but there'll be a lot more about the Middle Way as a more universal approach. Okay, so starting off with the story of the Buddha, which I'm sure you've probably heard. Have you all heard the basic life story of the Buddha at some point? Yeah, so. Yeah, the classic story as it's been handed down traditionally of the prince who's brought up in great comfort in the palace, and he leaves the palace because of dissatisfaction with suffering or dukkha or frustration in his experience. And classically, you're supposed to encounter the foresight, so he finds out about old age, sickness, and death, and about the alternative of being able to go forth. And so he goes forth into the jungle to try and find enlightenment, is a classic way of talking about it. He searches for enlightenment in the homeless life, and he tries out two different teachers, and eventually he falls in with five ascetics. And then the story goes, he's not satisfied with any approaches, but eventually he finds the middle way, and that brings him to enlightenment. So that's the classic story that you can piece together from the Pali Canon, the various versions of it collected together, or you can read the Buddha Charita or various biographies of the Buddha that have collected it together classically. Now, actually, my sort of prime inspiration for the Middle Way is just from that story, rather than the Middle Way as a teaching. So, just think about the balance in the story. So he starts off with this life of ultimate comfort, where he's supposed to have absolutely everything, to be cushioned from any kind of pain is, the way it's classically presented. Now, obviously, this is symbolic. It's not possible to be cushioned from every kind of pain, but just take it all symbolically. He wasn't satisfied with that. Then he went forth from that to the opposite, to every kind of pain, to asceticism, to putting a lot of pain in himself. That didn't work either. So there's this basic dialectical structure, you could call it. So one way and then the other. There's two opposites. He tries out each opposite. He realizes neither of those opposites is going to work in the way it's been presented to him. He has to find a better route in between them somewhere. And there are different ways you can characterize the life in the palace and the life in the jungle. What they've got to do with the two sides of the Middle Way, but the classic Buddhist way of talking about it is eternalism and nihilism. So the life in the palace is associated with nihilism or with self-indulgence, and the life in the jungle is associated with eternalism or with asceticism. Now, my approach to this generally is epistemological, in the sense that I'm concerned with how we find these things out. So epistemology is the study of beliefs and how we justify our beliefs. So the Buddha's life story for me conveys a method rather than a result. And that's what I'd suggest is the universal element of the story that we can take out of it. Obviously, the traditional Buddhist emphasis in this, obviously it's there in the Buddhist tradition, the middle way in the story, but the emphasis is very much on the result, enlightenment. He gains enlightenment, and then he taps into all these truths that he then tries to convey. Generally, I think that's likely to be much less relevant to us, what he thinks are truths at that time. They may have been relevant to him at that point or to other people at that point. They're less likely to be relevant to us now. But also, almost by definition, enlightenment is supposed to be difficult to understand. So, you know, even if we took everything the tradition says about enlightenment at face value, there'd still be a lot of difficulties with it. So it seems to be much more useful to focus on the method. And apart from that, there are all kinds of ways the middle way is talked about in the Buddha's teachings from the beginning. So what's traditionally the very first sermon, as it's called, contains basically three areas of teaching. There's the Four Noble Truths, that's the Eightfold Path, and there's the Middle Way. So it's there from the beginning in what's... Yeah, when he gains enlightenment, goes back to meet the five ascetics, again, who he's walked away from, and he's trying to explain to them what he thinks he's discovered, and those are the three things he talks about. He talks about the Four Noble Truths, and Eightfold Path, the Middle Way. So the Middle Way is, at least it's a third or a crucial element, even of traditional teachings as they've expanded at that point. But then I want to just pick out a few other key, parables mainly, or references to the Middle Way in Buddhist scriptures. I mean, there's a vast volume of stuff in the Buddhist scriptures. A lot of it is really not that interesting. But there are some very, very interesting bits. So it's a question of finding them. So the lute strings analogy is one of the things in the Pali Canon I love most. It's the Buddha's talking to a monk who's been sort of sweating and straining in his meditation, and trying to explain to him how he can get it right. And he talks about tuning a lute. So you don't have the string too taut, you don't have it too slack, you've got to get it just the right tension. And obviously that makes sense to a guitarist, I assume. So obviously that's a metaphor for the middle way. It's, finding that balancing point in the way we live our lives, and the way the judgments we make, and the kind of tension we put ourselves under as well, actually. So we can think of ourselves and our bodies as lute strings. Then there's the parable of the raft, which is actually found in the same sutta as the snake's head, which is the next one I wanted to talk about. The parable of the raft, first of all, is the story that... It was a parable, really. Yeah. If a person wanted to cross the Ganges, he would get on a raft and go across the Ganges to the other side. And then the Buddha asks, well, would he then pick up his raft and carry his raft further on his journey? And of course, his interlocutor says, no, he'd leave it behind. And so he says, just like that is the Dharma. So you use certain teachings or certain ideas or certain philosophies for a certain purpose, and they serve that purpose, and then you might leave them behind. Which suggests that, again, that there aren't kind of ultimate truths that we adopt for all time and then continue to carry around with us when they're not relevant. The snake's head metaphor, which follows that, has a similar point. In fact, it's a water snake in the original version. So it simply goes that you don't grasp a snake's head in the wrong way so that the snake can bite you. you've got to grasp it in the right way. He says the teachings are like that. So, again, it seems that something which might appear to be very valuable and very useful could still turn around and inflict a poisonous bite on you if you're not careful, if you don't grasp it in the right way. Then there's the Kalama Sutta, which is seems to be the nearest thing that we get to an epistemology explained in the Pali Canon. So where the Buddha talks about how he thinks we should go about finding things out and discovering and making judgments. And he does this to a group of people called the Kalamas, who are a bunch of villagers who he meets who come to him with questions. And they're confused because lots of different teachers have come to preach to them, to tell them what they should believe, and they don't know who to believe. So they ask the Buddha, they say there's always different ascetics and Brahmins, as they call them, these different people claiming different things. Who should we believe in? How do we go about thinking about this? And the Buddha basically responds that when you know in yourselves, or when you, in your experience, when you understand that teaching works, then that's the one you should follow. And so there's a basic appeal to experience in the Kalama Sutta. There's also, of course, a lot of dispute about the interpretation of the Kalama Sutta in Buddhism, but I'm not going to go into that. We could talk about it later if you want. Okay, and then final thing just to mention, I think, so everything I've said so far, everything I've referred to so far, is in the Theravadin tradition in the Pali Canon, so the oldest Buddhist scriptures. The Mahayana tradition, which followed from that, has a lot of emphasis on the middle way, which is why it's ended up being talked about such a lot, for example, in Tibetan Buddhism. So the doctrine of emptiness comes up quite a lot. And so if you read things like the Diamond Sutra, particularly, is a sort of statement in Mahayana Buddhism of the, I would call it skepticism. It's an ultimately skeptical position that there are no sort of final truths which you can put in words, even including the truths of Buddhism. And that's made quite explicit in the Diamond Sutra. And Nagarjuna was the philosopher of the Mahayana who formalized that or put it into more philosophical terms. So Nagarjuna is one of the figures that's revered in the Mahayana tradition, particularly the Tibetan tradition. Okay, so we've got all this stuff about the middle way in the Buddha's teachings as they come down to us, but probably more importantly, there's also a lot of middle way in the way Buddhist practice works. So obviously that's more important. You know, if you try Buddhist practices, you find you have to practice the middle way in order to do them. So the most obvious thing which you've probably encountered is meditation, and I've already talked about the lute strings analogy, which was meant to apply to meditation. So sometimes that's also talked about as balanced effort. So the idea that we maintain a continuous purpose in meditation, but at the same time, it's possible to try in too willful a fashion, to clench ourselves up, as it were. And that's counterproductive because we won't actually be accessing those elements of our minds which are not under that kind of very strenuous willful control. So it's the whole of our minds or the whole of our psyches we need to work with when meditating, not just that little bit, that section of the frontal lobes, which is clenched in willful effort. So that's obviously one area where you practice the middle way, but practical ways of dealing with craving. So again, I've heard Buddhists talk about this in various contexts. You know, what do you do if you've got a craving for chocolate biscuits or whatever it is? Probably doesn't work if you just give it up. You know, you've got to find a way of working with that craving, neither indulging it nor just cutting it off. Obviously, the various ways of doing that, which people who work with addiction these days will know far more about. But tapering off or finding the substitutes, or but in some ways those two energies, the energy which wants to eat chocolate biscuits and the energy which wants to not eat the chocolate biscuits, have to work together in some way rather than battling against each other. So that kind of insight, which is really about integration, which I'm going to talk about more in the next talk, seems to be there in the Buddhist tradition. And then also in the Buddhist tradition, you get a lot of pragmatic adaptation to different settings. So if you look at the development of Buddhism through the ages, it started off in India, and assumed quite different forms, a whole variety of schools. Particularly, for example, if you look at the way Buddhism adapted when it moved over to China, it let go of a lot of things which you might assume to have been almost sacred to it in India. So like the fact that monks were not supposed to work in India. When they came to China, where there was this strong work ethic that everybody should work and it's good for the spirit and so on, then monks started working. So the whole culture, you know, shifted in those sorts of situations.